welcome back to Transatlantic History Ramblings with Lauren and Brian. However, it is not Lauren and Brian today. We have a very, very, very special guest co-host. And as I was told, the proper introduction I have to read for you, my mother wrote when she found out who my guest co-host was to be, and she says, I have to introduce him as, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Hallmark's latest heartthrob, the one and only Jeremy King. Jeremy, how are you?
Oh, wow. Wow. That was great. That's a lot of technology since the last time I've been here.
Yeah, you know, we've put at least a nickel into the show.
I can tell.
Hallmark's latest heartthrob.
Yeah.
How's it feel?
I mean, it feels like a taste of love.
It does. It feels like a taste of love. And a taste of love is just a smidge better than a sinister seduction.
Is it, though?
I was going to name this episode Sinister Seduction.
You should have named this episode Sinister Seduction.
But my mother insisted Hallmark's latest heartthrob.
Well, I mean, your mom always likes a little taste of love. That's what we call it. That's our nickname for it.
She did say she misses you. Hasn't seen you around the apartment in a while.
As I do her.
Yeah, well, you know.
I mean, as I do her.
As I do her.
Like, as I miss her also.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, my cat's looking at me now like he's talking dirty about grandma.
It's creepy.
It's a little creepy. I
mean, it's creepy that you talk to your cat.
Well, what's really creepy is the cat talks back.
That's even more creepy.
What else is creepy is that Lauren is on holiday. Lauren number one isn't here, so...
Hello! I am here, Brian!
Oh, Lauren! Here. How was holiday?
Oh, I'm not on holiday. I have to leave early. So I just wanted to come in quick a bit, say hi and have some biscuits and tea. And but I have to do go.
Very good. Bye, Lauren. You're running away from Jeremy?
No. I wish I could stay with Jeremy. I'm running away from you.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
Yes.
I could be Buffalo's latest heartthrob.
I also have made love to your mom, and it's a wonderful experience. We quite enjoy it. We have a spot of tea afterwards, and maybe a cigar.
It is 2024. I'm not judging you.
Nor am I judging your mother for being quite seductive.
Well, sinister seduction.
Yes, it was quite a sinister seduction. I don't know if that's a movie or not, but it'd be a great name for one. It'd be quite fun.
Yeah, I think we should all IMDb that now.
We should. Yes.
Yeah.
Or A Taste of Love, which is what I call your mom's cooch.
Wow. I haven't heard the word cooch since 1987.
Yes, well, I have to go now, Brian. So enjoy the show. Toodaloos.
Bye, Lauren.
Your fake girlfriend again, back from her apartment across the street. Okay, goodbye.
Wow, that was nice of Lauren to stop by.
Wow, that was really nice of her to stop by.
She didn't even acknowledge you, though.
You know, I think you guys just have such a strong, rich history that maybe she's just more concentrated on, you know, starting up the show.
That could be. Well, speaking of history, this is a history show, as you know.
It is.
I guess tonight, which is, you know, the interview is pre-recorded, so you won't be there for that. But
Who is your guest tonight?
My guest tonight is one of the great historians and writers and researchers and authors of all time, the legendary Mr. Paul Begg, who is not only all of what I've said before, he is my hero and my initial inspiration, and he is the man that made me want to become a writer in the first place. And he's our guest later tonight. And any time I'm talking to Paul Begg, because I was lucky enough to have a hero become a friend, my brother likes to make fun of me that even though him and I are friends now, we can't have a normal conversation because it's literally me fawning over and obsessing over Paul Begg the whole time, and he calls it me playing the Begg pipes. So if y'all stick around, you'll get to hear Brian play the bagpipes a little later.
Just a bagpipe.
Just one bagpipe, yeah.
Just a bagpipe.
So, speaking of Sinister Seductions and Tastes of Love, you've been a busy, busy man lately.
Yes, I have. Yes, I have.
And would you like to share some?
So, 10 months ago, thereabouts, I put it in my wife. Okay. Didn't think anything was going to happen.
You've done it before.
She had been talking about wanting to have another child, and I was sort of like, you know what? We're good. But for a split second, I was like, you know what? Give her what she wants. And then afterwards, I was like, what are the chances? And then we had a baby. Well, I don't know how it all works. The stork delivered it. It was beautiful. They dropped it off at our door. And she's great. She's great. She's 5 weeks old now.
5 weeks old. Congratulations.
Yes, thank you.
So, my question is, where are you putting this?
How does it
all
work? So, what happens is, apparently there's a site on the internet, and you put in an order, and then the stork delivers your baby.
Is it a real stork, or just someone in like a stork costume?
No, it's a real stork. I mean, she dropped the baby from pretty high, and we don't know if she's okay or not because the padding, it was just a bunch of diapers at the bottom of the parachute. So we're not quite sure if it held up or not. You think they'd give him a little baby helmet?
I have seen the pictures. The padding held up because she is absolutely beautiful, and you should be a proud father, which kind of surprised me when I saw that last Hallmark movie that you were capable of having children with women.
Well, you know, I'm an actor.
Oh, yeah, well, some people just look so natural.
Much like O.J. Simpson in that murder trial, I often go to a different place and I make things up.
Well, okay, first off, Orenthal James Simpson has recently passed away. Please show some respect, because you are talking to someone in Buffalo, one of the only cities in the country that actually still liked him.
As Jesus told me, the juice is loose.
But Jesus tells you a lot of things, though. I don't know.
Because
I'm not sure if it's really Jesus or Byron Brown as one-eyed.
Oh, I'm sorry. It wasn't Jesus. It was one-eyed Don. One-Eyed Don tells me many things.
God, we got to get a One-Eyed Don movie made.
Oh, I'm working on it.
So, here's the other cool thing about you being here. Instead of Lauren, I get to try jokes on you and see if you laugh at them, because Lauren laughs at none of my jokes.
Okay.
All right. Probably won't. You probably won't. I even wrote them down because I wanted to get some good ones.
Okay.
All right.
Are these jokes that have to do with history? Because I feel like they should.
Well, I have some that do.
You know what Abraham history joke? Lincoln said to his wife just before he passed? Told you we shouldn't see this play.
All right. Okay. Here's one. History. You want a history joke?
Yep.
All right. So a Roman walks into a bar and says, "I'll have a martinis." Bartender says, "You mean a martini?" The Roman says, "No, if I wanted a double, I would have asked for one." No?
Okay.
All right, well.
Is the Martinez a Roman?
It's, you know, how you pluralize in Rome. Never mind. When I got to explain it, it's bad.
Yeah.
Oh, how about this?
Okay.
Did you know you can put snakes on your head to cure a migraine? Did you know that, Jeremy?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, it's true. Somehow it's oddly medicinal.
All right, that one was pretty good. I'll give you that one.
You give me that one? All right, okay, let me try. Here's one that's up your alley.
Okay.
All right, now this is one, and you might actually use this one.
I probably will. You know what joke I use a lot, by the way? What? The joke you told me online.
Oh.
You sent me a message, and you said, what's the difference between a pound and a dollar? And I was like, man, what? Like, one's English, one's American. Man, I can't figure this out. And I said, what? And you said, I don't dollar your mom. Oh. That one should definitely be on the show. That one should definitely. I use that all the time now. I actually, we were driving to school the other day, like my 10-year-old. I was dropping my 10-year-old off to school. And I go, hey, buddy, what's the difference between a dollar and a pound? And he goes, what? And I go, oh, man, nope, too early. Nope. And I go, a pound is a British coin, a British measure of money, and a dollar is American.
You were tempted,
and he was so confused. Huh?
I could tell you would have been tempted to tell him that.
Oh, dude, I was.
You are the king of your mother jokes.
Yeah, I was very close, but I was like, he's not quite ready. He'll go tell it in class, and then he'll get in trouble. But yeah, that's my go-to joke right now.
That's a great. Well, this might become your new one. Got to clear my throat for this one. So, woman walks into a bar and says, "I'll have a double entendre." So he gives it to her.
Double on tongue. Double on tongue.
I like that one. So he gives it to her. Yeah, so, well.
Hey, they can all be winners.
Yeah, well, okay, here's one for our smart listeners. Are you a smart listener, Jeremy?
Probably not.
This one... I don't know if it's for the smart listeners or the super nerdy listeners.
What's going on with your hair tonight, by the way? For guests that can't see, so I think he has a fan blowing in his hair, and it looks like a Sports Illustrated shoot. Like,
well,
he keeps flapping his hair, and then it just blows in the wind, but it's just straight back. Like he's got like a big fan going.
I do. Wanted to do the whole. I was gonna have the water coming down like Flashdance since you were on.
Imagine, if you will, Sasquatch in a Sports Illustrated shoot. His hair blowing in the breeze. He's eating jerky.
Jerky's good.
I had a turkey stick right before I came up.
Jerky is fucking delicious.
It is.
All right, my last joke, just for the nerds in the crowd. So, did you hear magnesium formed an oxide layer? OMG.
Okay.
All right. Yeah.
That was definitely better than your double entendre.
The double entendre is great. He gives it to her.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. You like medicinal.
I like medicinal, and I like the OMG. And my favorite to this day is the difference between a dollar and a pound.
A dollar and a pound is good.
Because it's a mom joke.
It is. And
all right, next time I'm on, you can only do mom jokes.
Yeah, instead of these dad jokes. Speaking of moms, I gotta blow the whistle on your roommate or your former roommate or room partner or whatever you want to call her. So, my mother...
Oh, your mom.
Yeah, we communicate a lot via Facebook Messenger and Instagram.
Your mom, my girlfriend.
Yes, she is addicted to Instagram. Like, she'll send like 1,000 Instagrams a day. It's really freaky. And I don't use Instagram, so I keep telling her, yeah, I'm not getting all these messages.
You know what's even worse?
What's that?
My dad gets his news now from TikTok.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Really? He sends me some... He sends me stuff from TikTok, and I'm like, I just go, okay. Okay.
Well.
So anyway, your mom.
Yeah, she sends me something on Messenger the other day. And this is not the Instagram. This is the Messenger.
Okay.
And I open it up, and it's a link to a YouTube video.
Okay.
Guess what my mother sends me a YouTube video of?
A double entendre.
Quite close. A dude in a doctor's office with a boil in his ass crack getting it fucking popped by the doctor.
Oh, wow.
What
wow, Mom. The
fuck is that all about?
Yeah, your mom's into some freaky stuff.
And she keeps yelling at me when I say he had a fucking boil on his asshole. It's not his asshole. It was just the crack. So I guess that matters.
Yeah, I think at that point it's a moot point.
Yeah, it's... So, your father, does he send you TikToks of people with boils on their butts?
He does not, but he sends me a lot of, like, fake news and a lot of conspiracy theory stuff that's pretty out there. And I'm like, Dad, you know... I'm like, Dad, you know this is TikTok, right? And he's like, but I've seen it on a couple different places now. Like, oh boy,
you got to get him listening to
it's like show. He's verifying his sources from other sources on TikTok.
Well, that's what they do now, but it's funny because we usually that's what these kids do these days, but we're talking about your dad.
Well, like if you see it four times, it's true, right? Like my son sees stuff on YouTube, he'll see YouTube videos, he goes, Dad, you know, like blah blah blah, like I can't even think of something that he said. I'm like, dude, that's not true. He's like, no, it is true. I've seen it. And I'm like, okay. Well,
you know what's hilarious? That happens all the time with a certain very, very, very famous podcaster who we're not going to name, but like he's probably the most famous podcaster in the world now. And
does his name rhyme with Schmo Hogan?
It does, as a matter of fact. And he often goes into these long-winded things about, have you seen this? This is crazy. And it's some, like, weird conspiracy theorist bullshit that's totally debunked and fake. And sometimes his producer or guest will say, yeah, that's not real. And I've actually heard him say, well, why would it be on the internet if it's not real? Yes, folks, this is where people are now getting their news.
But it really is. There's no, like, and I know nobody trusts the mainstream media anymore. And they've been found to be, like, kind of paid off by our government in a lot of cases. But I mean, it's like, dude, I will look at any information with an open eye and you know, but oh my God, some of this stuff is just.
Does he believe birds are real?
Birds?
Yeah. Have you seen that one?
Yes. And he's not a flat earther.
Cause there is a big conspiracy. There are people who think birds are all fake.
Oh, like they're what? They're
not real. I'm seriously, dude, look into this. It's like drones? These rabbit hole conspiracy. There's people believe birds are fake. Birds. I had a pet bird once.
So you know they're real.
So I know he was real. I watched him die. I didn't kill him. He was old. He died of old age.
I choked him out. You probably watched him die because you were choking the life out of him.
Yeah, or it could be like Christy Noman shooting her puppy. Now, here's my question, Jeremy. Let's say, for argument's sake, you were to shoot a puppy.
Okay.
Which you would never, ever do. Folks, don't write in or send hate mail. Jeremy is like the biggest animal lover in the world. He's got a fucking menagerie on his farm.
He's got many cows and animals. Cows, goats, horses, dogs, bunnies. I don't have chickens yet, but I'm going to get them.
Kangaroos soon to be?
Oh, I will have a kangaroo or two.
So Jeremy loves animals, so he would never do this. But let's say you shot a puppy.
Okay.
Would you proudly brag about that in an autobiography?
I'm going to go with no on that one, Bob.
Yeah, I would think that's one thing you don't want the public to know. I mean...
What was the reason for shooting the puppy? Was it attacking another puppy? Was it attacking a baby?
No, she said that she just couldn't train it and didn't like it, so they shot it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's not a good excuse.
And that's her her bid to try to get a vice presidential nod. Mm. I shot a puppy, I'm so tough.
I shot a puppy.
You shot a
puppy. These days it'll probably work. These days it'll probably get
both. Look, right, left, whatever, everybody loves puppies.
Yeah, but we're getting to the point where it's like, you shot a puppy, you're tough. We don't want one of them dumb people that can't shoot a puppy in office, because you got to make some decisions sometimes to shoot a puppy.
But I, you know, I can make decisions, but I ain't shooting a puppy.
That's a good point.
And unless it was that fucking Scrappy Doo.
Mm.
Fucking hated him.
I like Scrappy Doo.
Scrappy sucked, dude, okay?
Scrappy, if I remember correctly, Scrappy was a little bit smarter than Scooby.
Well, that's a fucking rock. His cousin, is a little right? Smarter than Scooby, yeah.
It was his cousin.
Yep.
Scrappy oftentimes figured shit out.
Yeah, but he was a douche.
No, he was just very confident.
You are Team Scrappy.
I think I am.
I don't even know you anymore.
You're just mad because you look like the guy at the end of the Scooby-Doo cartoons that, like, they took the mask off and he...
If it wasn't for those meddling kids, that's me?
Yeah. If it wasn't for you meddling kids, I would have gotten away with shooting that puppy.
So, you're saying the guy at every end of Scooby-Doo looked like Sasquatch on a Sports Illustrated cover?
Yes. Until he took his mask off.
Yeah, I just caught my own reflection in the camera, and you're right. It's
when you take, right? It's quite
80s.
You really have it going on tonight. You're really flipping that hair.
Pretty sweet, actually.
Yeah. You got to go with that fan every night.
I got to carry it around with me.
You should.
No matter where I go, if I go to a restaurant, just put that on the table.
Hello. Hi. I'll have the steak.
If I ever get in a Hallmark movie, I will do that.
Hey, man, I know people.
I know you do. So let me ask you. We all know and love Rad Chad. We've done shows on Scare Package.
He's nobody awesome.
Champions that movie more than I do. Like, you know, I've sent copies of it all over the world, literally. I've sent it to several other countries. I've done shows on it. I've interviewed you. I've interviewed everybody in the cast, pretty much. The director, the producer, everything. So my audience really does know you from Scare Package. You are Rad Chad.
I am.
How different is the set of a Hallmark film as compared to the set of Scare Package?
It's really not so different. So on the Scare Package movies, we had Piranha, we had old movies, and we had stuff like that. In a Hallmark movie, you have live, beautiful fish, and you have women. And
not for your character.
Not for my character. I happen to be attracted to dudes. That was a decision that was made like 2 weeks before filming, and I was like, you know what? Whatever. Love is
love,
right?
Wait a second. Wait, well, hold the phone. You got to go back for a second. That wasn't in the initial script?
Oh, no. It was a straight couple. When I got cast, it was a straight couple.
And then they just said, you look so much more natural with a dude. We're going to stick you with a fella.
You know, who knows what decisions are made at, like, the executive level. Or, you know, this will appeal to more people if it's this or that. But they're like, look, we made the decision to make this character, you know, to make this couple look a gay couple. And I was like, you know what? And they said, you can do this role, or you can do the role at the beginning of the movie, like the really douchey guy on the bad date. There's like a guy, and it's funny. It's a funny scene, but I really wanted to work with Martin Cove. I really wanted to work with, you know, a larger part of the cast and be more in the film. So
you got more scenes.
Yeah. And so I was like, you know what? I don't care what it is. Who cares?
Exactly. No, right. It's 2024. We're not judging.
Right.
But it's funny because before the movie even came out, my mother, who is a Hallmark movie nut, she like TiVos every Hallmark film and watches them. She'll have like 50 of them lined up on her TiVo, and she'll call me going, I don't know why I'm watching all these fucking Hallmark movies, but I am. She asked me when I said, you know, Jeremy's in the one that's coming out next week. And she goes, ooh, will he be one of the gays? And I said, what do you mean? She goes, oh, every Hallmark movie now has a gay couple.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a thing.
Or a lesbian couple, but mostly gay couple. And she's not saying this like out of like weirdness. She's just like, it's just what it is. And then she says, ooh, will he be one of the gays? Which is, it makes it sound like a bad turn of phrase, like those gays, but that's not how she meant it. And I said, I don't know. I don't think so. And then lo and behold, you met salsa class.
When you meet the man of your dreams in a salsa class, you just got to go with it.
She did tell me tonight, if he tries to teach you salsa, blow your hair with the fan to try to encourage.
Right. It always makes you look better. It always makes you look better.
Yeah, it does. But you are now Hallmark's latest heartthrob. So that's got to be good. That's like should be your new like Twitter handle.
What's your Twitter handle? It's Hallmark Heartthrob.
No, Hallmark's latest heartthrob.
Hallmark's latest heartthrob.
Now, speaking of heartthrobs, I'll actually be seeing a buddy of yours next month. I will be seeing the Devil's Lake Impaler.
Oh boy, yes you will. Yeah.
I will be seeing Dustin.
Dustin Rhodes.
Any messages? Anything you'd like me to pass along to Dustin?
Give him a big hug for me.
I don't want him to punch me in the fucking face and kill me.
And he likes, instead of kisses on the cheek, he likes when you nibble his ear.
I've heard that.
Yeah.
I heard you learn that in salsa class.
No, I learned it on the set of Scare Package 2. He was very forthcoming. No, he's a great dude. Like, he's one, like, it was one of those things where, like, with Joe Bob and with him, you don't know how people are going to be. So you kind of like give them their distance and let them like kind of approach you because you don't want to be like the D-bag that's like, you know, fangirling or whatever. And dude, he was just so down to earth and so cool and told us so many fucking funny stories about his wrestling days and stuff like that. And it was just awesome.
And his father's the American Dream.
Right.
Dustin Rhodes, the American Dream, baby.
That is correct.
And he's a legend, man. And
you write about in your book.
So I do have another topic I wanted to bring up. Because did you see? Now, I don't know. In the movie, in the Hallmark film, you did go to get cocktails. So I don't know if you like to imbibe.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see Danny Trejo's new drink?
I did not.
He actually is putting tequila. Yeah, it's Trejo Spirits. Zero proof tequila. Non-alcoholic tequila.
Now, I can say this. I can say that I've known a lot of people that are, like, going the non-alcoholic route. And while my wife was pregnant, we had a big bonfire party. And our friend Vicky is dating someone that works for an alcohol company. And he brought zero-proof tequila to make margaritas. And at first, I was making fun of it because I'm like, I don't, like, alcohol doesn't taste good. You do it to get drunk, right? But obviously, my wife was pregnant, and she couldn't do that. But she said she actually really enjoyed it because it tasted like the same thing. It made her, like, part of the group. And now she drinks non-alcoholic mango cart. It's a beer. Like, it's a beer. And it's like 0% mango cart.
Well, I understand. For the taste and flavor.
Like I said,
I mean, people aren't drinking like domestic beer and like, you know, Budweiser for the flavor, but, you know, more of a pale ales and stouts and things they will drink.
Yeah, you know. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I understand it, and the people that like it, cool.
Yeah, but
the funny thing is, non-alcoholic beer, like, so my wife started, she was told to drink stout to, like, improve her milk production, right? So the regular Guinness stout is, like, $6 for, like, a six-pack or something. The non-alcoholic Guinness stout is $10 for a four-pack. And I'm like, so there's no alcohol in it, and you're charging, like, double.
Cool. Well, yeah. See, there's this. See, your father's conspiracy. I hope he doesn't listen to this part of the show, because I don't want to send him down any more conspiracy rabbit holes.
Oh, there's plenty.
But as you know, I'm an old man now. You know, I'm in my 50s now.
You look like you're 90.
Yeah, thank you. It's the blowing hair. But you know, I got a lot of health issues. I'm in my 50s. You know, so. Diet has to completely change. You know, I'm diabetic. I have all these issues to begin with. So I eat, like, nothing but healthy food now. No carbs, no sugars, no nothing. Fucking healthy food is at least 4 times more expensive than shit food.
Right, right.
Like I can't eat bread anymore. I can't eat any of that shit. So if I were to go buy, like, think of 12 flour tortillas, it's like $3. These 8 non-carb ones, $12.
I know. I started buying the.
But look how good I look, man. You know.
Right. Yeah. Hey, man. It's all about your health.
Lost a lot of weight. Grew out the beard. Got all the gray coming in.
I can't tell because the beard is so big. Like you know. You can't tell.
No, you can't.
But that's good, man.
No, it's not. $12 for fucking wraps.
But you know, you live longer, so.
Yeah, that's true. But I suppose we should go on to our, today in history segment of the show.
Let's do it.
I'll splice in, a big booming today in history at that point, but.
Today in history.
Bum, bum, bum.
Did you find a day in history?
I found two, my friend.
Oh, let's hear it. What do you got? Day in history.
Today in history, on this day, on May 8th, 1945, can you guess what happened?
I can't, because I don't have that one.
May 8th, 1945, was Victory in Europe Day. It's a day that Hitler quit.
Hitler,
so it was Victory in Europe Day. Now, Japan had not conceded the war, but it was Victory in Europe Day. You want to know an even better one?
I would love to know a better one.
Do you know what happened on this day? On this day, May 8th of 2010.
I should, because I was only in my 40s then.
Right, right.
Okay. What happened?
On May 8th of 2010, SNL officially had their oldest ever host. Can you guess who that was?
Wow. 2010, the oldest host on SNL. I don't know.
She was 88 years old at the time. Very funny gal. Funny throughout her ages, even when she was a golden girl.
Oh, yeah, Betty White.
Betty White. So Betty White hosted SNL this day.
I heard you used to date her, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We had some good times.
Just, you don't want to, you want to leave it at that, though, right?
All I can say is Betty loved the white.
I heard that. Yeah. Well, I got some interesting days in history, because I even have a couple extras that I didn't know if you'd have one.
Bum, bum, bum.
Oh, you, yeah.
That's cool. Or, you do it for yours, but you didn't do it for mine. Cool.
How about this one? Oh, Jeremy, you had days in history? No?
Keep the hair blowing, buddy.
Lauren, get out of here.
Oh, sorry about that. Gotta go.
So, today in history, May 8th, 1348.
Wow, we're going way back.
Yeah, we're going way back on that one. So, this ship from Bordeaux lands in England, right? Lands in Dorset. Guess what's on the ship?
Cocaina.
The Black Plague.
Wow.
They brought the plague on a boat today in history.
Wow. Wow.
That's pretty good. That's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Here's one I found interesting. I selected this one just for you. Because you have a new daughter, and you have another lovely daughter.
I do.
So this is something I would think might be right up there, Allie. Today in history, May 8th, 1835, was the very first publication of fairy tales by Hans Christian Andersen.
Wow.
Including his fairy tale, The Little Mermaid.
What?
Which premiered the Disney live action drama of The Little Mermaid, premiered today in history in 2023.
Wow. That is... So in 1835, that story was already written?
Well, a variation of it. I mean, the original Hans Christian Andersen story is pretty different, but,
right.
You know, but I just think it's cool that on the same day in history.
But she friends with crap? That's all I have to know.
Yeah. I know.
Under the sea, the world is brighter. Under the sea, you can't use a lighter.
Oh, and Ariel, we're gonna get sued, and we're gonna.
Oh, Ariel, I have to warn you, you'd make a bad mistake, girl.
You're a big Little Mermaid fan?
So my sister is 10 to 11 years younger than me. So growing up, this was on cassette, VHS. She must have watched The Little Mermaid 84,000 times.
Wow!
And then my daughter, who is now 4. Watched the original Little Mermaid when she was about 2, about 84,000 times. And then, what was it, last year when The Little Mermaid came out? She had a Little Mermaid birthday.
We went in history last year it
came
out.
Yes, May 8th. May 8th. She watched the new Little Mermaid, and we watched that 80,000 times. So, yes, I am a Little Mermaid aficionado.
That's... a little bit too much information, Mr. Salsa Class, but
you know, there it is.
You want some other interesting days in history since I got them?
I would love to hear it. Right. On this day in history.
Today in history, May 8th, 1933. Guess what happened?
Popeye ate his first can of spinach.
No, and you're so far off because it has more to do with not eating. Today in history, May 8th, was the first day of Gandhi's 21-day fast to protest England.
It was only a 21-day fast?
Yeah, it was only 21 days. He's kind of a wuss.
Yeah. I've done 7-day fast before.
Like, Ben Kingsley, when he played Gandhi, looked like he fasted a lot more in 21 days just to play him.
I thought he went on a food strike for much longer than that.
Not 21 days.
Okay. 21 days, still badass.
I was going to say, you're trying to say Gandhi wasn't so badass anymore?
No. That's badass. I've done a 7-day fast before, and it's pretty tough.
Why?
But I don't think Gandhi was, like, working out every day either, you know?
Why would you go on a 7-day fast?
It's really good for your body. It resets... so many things. You get rid of a lot of senescent cells, which are like the dead cells and the bad cells that eventually become cancer. It resets so many things in your body. It's just really good for you.
And how often do you do this?
I try to do it once a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Not even pizza, huh?
No, literally it's water. Like, I'll have coffee the first 2 days. But then, like, caffeine, I become very, like, usually I need 2 cups of coffee in the morning. I'll have a pre-workout before I work out, and then I'll usually do an energy drink around 4 o'clock. So I drink a lot of caffeine. But when you're fasting, by like day three, I can't even have like a half a cup of coffee because it just makes you feel like you're like on a cocaine binge.
Well, my question is, after that many days, how do you not? Because isn't getting that out of your system good for you too?
Well, you know, what's really interesting is that the first 3 days, you're kind of flushing out your system. And then your body turns into cleaning. Yeah. And then your body turns into cleaning everything out. So, like, the strange thing is, like, day four, day five, you don't really go. Day six, you start getting these weird Hershey squirts that smell like death. Like, imagine if you murdered a puppy and you left it out in the sun. And left it out in the sun for like 10 days and then you sniffed it. That's what the things that come out of your body at that point, that's what it smells like.
Wait, we should do that again. I'll play some sad music over it.
Okay, ready?
So on day four.
On day five or six. Body. It smelled like death.
That was good.
Yeah.
I got one more day in history for you. Today in history, May 8th,
1953. The Chevy Chevelle first came out.
No! WIPB TV 49 in Muncie, Indiana begins broadcasting. Why is that significant, you may ask?
I would ask.
Why should we care about Muncie, Indiana PBS stations, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I bet their show on there was Mr. Rogers.
No, that was Pittsburgh.
Okay. I bet their show on there was Sesame Street.
You're getting warmer.
I bet their show on there was Teletubbies.
WIPB TV 49 in Muncie, Indiana, the PBS affiliate, is the station that brought the world Bob Ross's The Joy of Painting.
Wow.
Who didn't love Bob Ross's Joy of Painting?
I mean, how could you not? The hair. The
happy little trees.
Yeah.
Happy trees. Yeah.
A lot of clouds.
Yeah, and you know, you don't make mistakes. Just make happy accidents.
Wow. That's what I call my daughter.
Oh! On that note, what do you say I fire up the magic interview box?
Boop, 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 boop.
And we bring the people the interview with the legendary Paul Begg. But before I do, Jeremy, do you have anything to plug other than the fact that 10 months ago you had sex?
The only thing I want to plug is your mom.
What about, where can we watch The Taste of Love?
Taste of Love is already premiered, but you can still find it on the Hallmark Channel or on Peacock. And I think you can still find Sinister Seduction on Amazon Prime, and you can find Scare Package 1 and 2 on the ever-amazing Shudder.
Not only on Shudder, folks, but if you're not strictly horror movie fans, but you are fans of films and classic films, AMC Plus will give you free access to Shudder, where you can stream Scare Package 1 and 2, see the legendary Jeremy King, and if that's not enough King for your courts, get Pirates of the Caribbean, because one of the Pirates of the Caribbean is our own Jeremy King.
Well, we won't tell you which one.
No.
And if you want to plug Brian's mom, she is starting an OnlyFans soon. It's going to be great.
It's already started.
Her doing anything nasty. It's just a bunch of her Instagram stories shared on this OnlyFans page.
Usually involving people with pimples with in
anal
their
inflammation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Him going to the Rear Admiral to get checked out. Jeremy, I cannot thank you enough for being the substitute Lauren for today's show.
And you're welcome.
You've got to come back on soon for an actual full episode.
I will.
And I'm going to fire up that magic interview box and bring on the legendary Paul Begg.
It's the Magic Interview Box.
He's about to suck those bagpipes. Everybody ready? Bum, bum, bum.
All right, folks. I am so excited for today's show because it's not every day you get to talk to a hero. And it's really bizarre because, you know, there's that old adage, never meet your heroes, you'll be disappointed. This is the opposite effect. The man I have on today is not only one of the greatest writers and researchers and historians in history. This is the man that made me want to be a writer. No exaggeration. The first time I picked up one of his books, I decided at that moment I wanted to be a writer. And here it is many, many, many years later. And I'm extremely proud to say that not only is he still my favorite writer and hero, but also a friend. So, ladies and gentlemen, the legendary Paul Begg joins us once again. Paul, how are you?
I am doing extremely fine, especially after that welcome.
Well, you know, it's all true, too. That's the sad thing. I wear it right on my sleeve. I can't hide it. Well, I think I tell you that every time I talk to you.
I know, which is why we don't talk all that often. I'm too modest for all of this. So.
Oop, I think we lost you for a second. You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. So before we get started, before we start talking about your amazing career, your legendary research and everything else, I want to verify, you are in Wales, correct?
I am indeed, yes. Yes, I'm living in a blink and you've missed it village in the foothills of Snowdonia. It's I'm very lucky, it's an extremely beautiful area. My only regret is that I don't have a great view from my office window, but if I go out through the front door, I can, I'm straight away just got mountains and sheep and
That's what I was going to ask. The sheep. Is it true that everybody in Wales gets sheep to keep?
No. And we don't go out with
Is that a sheep in your living room?
Well,
if
I was to open my front door, you'd probably be able to hear quite a lot of them doing that.
Yeah, well, what is with the sheep there? I mean, you guys got tons of sheep.
Well, it's mountainous area, so it's not good for growing vegetables or anything, and you can't get a tractor up the hills, up the mountains. So sheep are pretty good. They're all right. They don't mind the mountains, and they quite like the weather, which is
tasty.
And well, if you see the little ones running across the field as you're sitting, looking out through your window, watching television, and then it kind of puts you off eating them a bit. They look so cute.
Well, that's why you eat mutton. Eat the old ones.
Yeah. But they should be in retirement, in a nice, comfortable place. And
no sheep in Buffalo.
Right.
Not sheep one.
Not quite sure what to say to that, but
you're supposed to feel bad for me.
Yeah, I that goes without saying that I do.
But that's just because I'm an American, you feel bad for me. You see the state of the world.
Yeah, well, my daughter's just got back from America, and she one of the first things that she did was make a cup of tea.
That's right. You said she was in Florida, correct?
That's right, yeah. She'd gone for a fortnight with her husband to Euro Disney, or not Euro Disney, sorry, you know, the Florida Disney. And so having been to Euro Disney and sort of loved that, so she'd been to the Florida one. And loved it, had a great time.
And did she love it?
Yeah, she She really did. And she also went to Minion Land, but I think she went there just for me, really, because she knows that I'm a massive Minion fan.
I get mocked for that a lot, but I love the Minions.
Mm, so do I. They make me laugh. Even
you
when
know
I'm
what else makes
me laugh. Laugh?
What else makes me laugh is that my brother makes fun of me every time I talk to you. Because he says it's so ridiculous how I go complete and total fanboy on you. So I will be made fun of for this, by the way.
Well, deservedly so, I think. Very difficult to have a fan like that, like you.
Well, I'm not a stalker. Don't worry, because I'm not getting on a plane to see the sheep.
No, well, you're more than welcome to come and see the sheep.
I would love to. I would love to visit Wales. You know, obviously to go see Lauren, our regular co-host, who's not here today because she's under the weather. Mm. But, you know, she's in your home country, too. I'd kill two birds with one stone on that one.
Yeah, Lauren is down in South Wales, isn't she?
Swansea.
So Swansea, yeah. So I was actually born in Cardiff, which is nearby, just near to Swansea. But, you know, when I came back to Wales, my wife and I decided that that Mid Wales was where we would come, because as a child, she used to spend her holidays in a place called Bethgelert, which is not too far away from me. And I used to spend my holidays when I was a kid in Shrewsbury, where my aunt lived. And that's in England, but we allow it to be because it used to be Powys in a long, long time ago, in about the year 500 or thereabouts. So, you know, we have long memories. And so that where we are now just seemed ideal. It was in between the two.
I just love that you named all these cities in Wales that even I could pronounce, because every time I look at it on a map, there's all these places that I couldn't even come close to pronouncing.
Hmm. Well, yes, I have the same problem. At least it's a little bit easier. I mean, I was just going to say, when I was a child, I could count up to 10 in Welsh. That was about the best that I could do. I was taught Welsh for 8 years, but I just managed to count up to 10. But over time, I'd forgotten and lapsed into German, which is very similar. The numbers, ein, zwei, drei, pedua, pimp is Welsh, and ein, zwei, drei, vier, fünf is German. So, but I always got stuck around 6.
Well, because you only have 5 fingers on a hand.
That's right. And also, Welsh for 6 is something along the lines of chwech, which sounds like you're clearing your throat. So it isn't quite it's a little bit more difficult to do. You get down in die tri pedwar pimp. And if you go on with the rest of it, but
yes, you start as you're from the UK, you end up speaking Yiddish, and I don't understand that.
No, I don't either. But
however, Lauren is Welsh speaking, and her nephews go to a Welsh language school, which I'm surprised they still have Welsh language schools. I mean, I would think you'd have Welsh as a second language in school, but I would think English would be primary.
Well. Yeah, it's all part of the desire of the Welsh to actually preserve the language. And now where I live, there are lots of Welsh speakers. So if I go to the doctor's surgery or the pub across the road, there'll be groups of people and they can be talking in Welsh. It's almost their first language. So it was quite funny, really, because it's amazing how quickly you get used to there being groups of people talking in a language that that you're too stupid to have learned when you were in school. But it was great when I was in Venice earlier this year, and of course there are a lot of people there speaking Italian. And it seemed perfectly normal to have groups of people talking in a language that I didn't understand.
The only equivalence we have to that here is because we have three major universities right around where I live. So we have students from all over the world. And if you go to certain of the restaurants or bars right near there, you'll see the packets of people from Pakistan and a group of kids from China and a group of kids from India and a group of kids, you know, from all over the world. So you'll hear like six different conversations in six different languages.
Hmm.
But once you're a mile away from the campus, that doesn't happen.
No. Well, yes, it's funny old world, really.
It is. And it's such a small world now with the internet and how, I mean, just as an example, we are on other sides of an ocean right now, speaking in real time with no delay, no lag, no nothing. Could you imagine, as a researcher, as a historian, how easy your job would have been 30, 40 years ago, if the internet were around and you could do research that way without ever having to leave your office?
Well, I think that it's quite interesting. I was actually saying to my wife this morning something similar, because my daughter was on the plane coming back from the States and she'd got Wi-Fi, so she was able to talk to us. And we're saying, here we are in a little Welsh village and my daughter's in an aeroplane thousands of feet up, and we're having a conversation and behaving as if she was just down the road. It was, you know, it's nuts. The things that you can do today that we didn't used to be able to do in the past. And from the research point of view, you know, because I'm researching Jack the Ripper a lot of the time, we're talking about books and when these books, different books had been published. And there are certain things that one would have been unable to do, but would have been difficult to do prior to the year 2000, because it's only since then that we've had this vast digitization of newspapers, for example.
Exactly.
And believe it or not, sites like Ancestry only started in around about 2000. So they've only actually been, they seem as if it's been, they've been around for a lifetime, but they've only been around for about 20 years. And the amount of material that they've digitized and they have readily available. So you can go through all kinds of records just in a couple of mouse clicks. There is still an art to finding the information on the internet, and there are certain people who are extremely good at doing that. But nevertheless, you can still get up newspapers and just type in somebody's name and then get a whole load of newspaper references to that person. Whereas when I was working, first of all, that would have taken weeks and months and far more money than I had if I needed to go to London to do it and stay in a hotel and buy food and just be able to afford to take the time off work and away from family commitments to be able to do that sort of thing. And so people can now sit down at home with a cup of tea and do what I would have taken 6 months to do, and they can do it in an evening. It's so it It really is a completely different environment. But it as is. Computers have got simpler, I don't understand them anymore. I used to write for a major computer magazine in this country and review software for it at one point for quite a while. And all those magazines that used to clutter up the newsagent's shelf, these big fat computer magazines that I loved reading and going through, they're all defunct. They've all disappeared now as the computers are simplified. And yet they are now so complex that I really don't understand what I'm doing on them anymore.
And from a research standpoint, it in a certain respect, it's made a lot of, I don't want to just say modern day researchers, but it's made a lot of researchers lazy. Like, you can just put in a web search, like you said, go to a newspaper, type in a name, pull up some results, go to a search engine, pull up results, and they just go with it. And a lot of people trust that. In the due diligence of a true researcher doesn't seem to, it doesn't always seem to come through. You see a lot of, I call them Wikipedia mistakes.
Yeah. A double check, triple check, make sure your facts are right as best you can. I mean, mistakes always slip by, but, yeah, a friend of mine, co-author Keith Skinner, always used to argue that it was much, well, you should actually go and see the real documents, because he maintained that there were often little things that you didn't see in the digitization. And I mean, he's quite right, because occasionally there were penciled notes in the margins or something, and they didn't show up on the digitized screen. So, but right down to doing that, rather than just accepting the digitized image. But there is a certain laziness. There's a willingness to accept things. But then that doesn't really apply so much with the really good researchers that we've got these days, who understand what they're doing. But again, though, I mean, there are things like when it comes down to researching, you have the information that you get, which is the raw data, but then you have to interpret the raw data and put it into some understandable form, and that's another thing again that you have to understand the material that you're looking at, and that's that can involve you in reading very widely getting to understand a lot of stuff that's totally irrelevant to what you're actually writing, but you need to understand it in order to be able to slot the information that you do have into the wider context.
And you had mentioned it earlier. I mean, you really made it your name for yourself in the world of Jack the Ripper research, I don't care what anybody says. If there is a Mount Rushmore of quote unquote ripperologists, you, my friend, are certainly one of the faces on there. And I would say people like Martin Fido, like yourself, like Don Rumblow, but there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds that have come after you, and none of them have been able to, I guess, garner the respect that you did with a book like The Facts, Jack the Ripper, The Facts, or The Uncensored Facts, as the publisher originally called it. Why, with all the information do you think that so few people have come along that can match what you did as a researcher? I mean, outside of your flair for the writing, because that's a big part of it. But I mean, as far as the research angle goes, you never hear anybody talking about modern researchers being as credible as you.
Well, I would guess I think it's a little unfair on current researchers because they don't have as much to discover as there was to be discovered when I started. So when I started, back in, I think it was 1959 that Daniel Farson discovered what we call the McNaughton Memoranda, which names three people who the police obviously suspected at the time of being Jack the Ripper. And between that time and when I started in the 1980s, we only knew the name of one of those three men, and that was Druitt. But the other two we knew nothing about. So that was open for discovery. Now, Martin actually found one of them and I found the other. So, you know, that we had those things to discover. Nowadays, you don't really have major cap feathers to go after. So possibly it has something to do with that. But no, I'm just lucky and I'm very grateful that I haven't been found out yet, really.
I mean, you're right. There's a lot less to be discovered about the crimes themselves without the possibility of a time machine to go and see things, which is why I say, the one thing about suspect writers and researchers is no matter how much compelling evidence you think you have, you will never be able to say case closed, this is it.
That's partly due to the a sort of innate resistance that those who have alternative suspects have to towards anybody who comes up with another one. I'm not trying to say that theorists are massively resistant to new things. They're not, but it's understandable, I think, that when somebody has a suspect, they've actually invested a lot of time and a lot of effort and in some cases a lot of money in reaching that suspect and so all their conclusions, and they, you know, it's hard to give those up if you're facing a different suspect. So,
well, of course, and you may find some incredibly compelling evidence. I think that research should continue. And I think people, if they do go into a specialized field, they should, and they should keep digging, and they should keep showing what they find. Just don't claim this is it, we've solved it, and try to get a headline in the newspapers. Well, they don't even have newspapers anymore, but the tabloids. I mean, I've done a lot of work on suspects myself. I have ideas of strong possibilities or what I believe other people believed at the time, but I'll never be able to definitively say it unless Malcolm McDowell shows up here with a time machine and we can go and find him.
Yeah, well, that of course would be the wish of everybody, but I, as you know, Ripper Studies have divided really into two main strands. You've got those who are still suspect oriented, and then there are people like me and some others who are treating the case more as history and being fairly rigid in our determination that we want factual information. And so there's a whole group of researchers who are now pulling down some amazing information. But of course, it's not the sort that is the gosh wow information that people, publishers and the theorists want. So, there's still an awful lot out there to be discovered, but it's tiny stuff, and so it doesn't get the headlines, as it were.
It's also funny that people will talk about it's ghoulish to research this, and you know, I've been studying it and researching it for 30 some years now, probably 35 years now, thanks to a man named Paul Begg that inspired me. And my interest went from studying the crime to studying the suspects till it branched out till I became much more interested in studying the social, economic, and political strife of London at the time. So it's amazing how history just veers off into branches that, you know, my field of interest and study in this has nothing to do with the actual crimes anymore.
Yeah.
But just society as a whole of the time.
But that's quite a common thing. When I first started in a more serious way after The Uncensored Facts was published, there were people who I met for one reason or another who'd become interested in Jack the Ripper and had gone on and become local historians because they'd found a connection between Jack the Ripper and the place they lived. And of course, then they'd research that out and that would lead them on to something else. And so they suddenly became the go-to person to find out about that area of London or whatever it might be. So it's quite funny that when people come into the subject, they're drawn into the subject mostly by the mystery of who Jack the Ripper was. They stick around for a little while, discover that we'll never know who Jack the Ripper was in all probability, and then they drift away. But a bunch of other people stay on and they get attracted to, as did you, to other things. And it can be, it's extraordinary. It can be the geography of the area. They can become really fascinated by the positioning of lampposts and various street furniture and so forth, and try and plot all that sort of things out. They get interested in the pubs in the area and start looking into all the ones that no longer exist anymore, that have been knocked down or closed and converted into the other types of building. All manner of subjects people become interested in and experts in, all because they got attracted to it by Jack the Ripper.
One of the things that another part of it that fascinated me and I got really into for a while was the birth of sensationalist journalism because of it, and watching how it affected it on this side of the ocean. You know, because, hey, coverage of the Jack the Ripper crimes in the papers changed the way papers were on both sides of the Atlantic.
Well, it did, not on its own, of course. I mean, there was a lot of other reasoning, but it started in America, I think, really, the way that newspapers were done. You were the guys who introduced headlines and subheads and all the other paraphernalia that is now commonplace in newspapers, and also realized that you could write punchier news stories in order to entertain and inform a newly literate audience, because newspapers were responding to the fact that there were more people were learning to read and write, and therefore fighting a circulation war. to grab all these people in. And what was going on in America crept in over here at the same time. So around about the time of the Jack the Ripper murders, some papers were becoming a little bit more sensationalist in their approach to news gathering. So it's a really important time in so many ways. The technology of newspapers was changing as well, so they were able to print the papers, and it goes round to what we were talking about right at the start here, that the technology of here we are chatting in real time on different sides of the Atlantic. Well, back in 1888, with wireless telegraphy and things, the news stories were getting delivered far quicker than ever before. And so that was quite amazing. And people were staggered by all that going on and the way the newspapers were reacting to having news almost as it happened.
I love the way it was almost a backhanded compliment to America about how we're responsible for the sensationalism. It's like, I wanted to start the USA chant. We corrupted the news.
Absolutely, yes.
And we're proud of it.
But no, I mean, with people like William Randolph Hearst and so forth, yes, you started. But you also gave us Pulitzer, so I suppose it counterbalances.
Yeah, and Hearst gave us Charles Foster Kane, and without that, cinema would never be the same.
No. And mind you, I suppose the same source gave us War of the Worlds, that radio drama as well. So,
absolutely.
From the sublime to the ridiculous.
I love Orson Welles. Are you an Orson Welles fan?
Yeah.
I mean, how can you not be?
I for some reason, and I can't now remember the film very well, but The Magnificent Ambersons.
Oh, remember. Probably my favorite Welles film is Magnificent Ambersons.
I used to used to watch that.
And Orson Welles had the second greatest voice in the world, next to yours.
No, I've got a frog in my throat, which is.
But I always tell people, if I hit the lottery and I could actually hire someone to be the narrator for my life, it would be you.
Well, thank you.
That's what I would want. I would want that. Some people say Morgan Freeman. I say Paul Begg.
I think that's probably wrong. I think Morgan. You have to go a long way for Morgan Freeman. Richard Burton, I would be good. Fellow Welshman.
I was going to say, notice that they all are Welshies.
Well, the Welsh.
I mean, if it was going to be sung, it would be Tom Jones would sing My Life. Another Welshie.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, we get everywhere, the Welsh.
You do.
Not quite as much as the Irish, of course, but.
But, you know, you're also not as hated as much as the Irish around the world. Speaking as someone of Irish descent, I could say that.
Well, it's the one thing that's great about Wales that I've become aware of since moving back is that just how much stuff the Welsh make and are very proud of it, and especially in foodstuffs and drink and so forth. We have several small Welsh brewers who make some really good beer, and I sometimes have I've got a small supply of different Welsh beers as I find it, and I quite like to have a bottle of something occasionally. But they also are distilling whiskey and gin and a whole range of wines and things, and their foodstuffs and cheeses and Lots of stuff that they do here, and I'm far more aware of it than I've ever been before. Local bakers for bread and so forth. It's really in a way it's like going back to the 1950s. And you know, you have the as you call them, the, you know, the mom and pop store and so forth. It's and home baking and homemade products and so forth. It's good.
See, now I want to move to Wales. Why do you do this to me?
Well, I'm sorry. It's just my pride in Wales. I think I'm just impressed very much by all the things that are going on here.
I love my hometown. I love Buffalo. I'm the biggest proponent of Buffalo in the world. We invented the chicken wing. Well, we didn't invent it. We just first cooked them and ate them.
Is that why it's called Buffalo
wing? That's why they're called. Yeah, not here. They're not. They're just called wings here.
Yeah.
But I love that I'm 10 minutes from Niagara Falls. I love my hometown. But come on, man. All those things you just said about Wales. You know, we have a listener to the show who's got a young daughter who he lets listen. You know, he'll listen to the episodes first to make sure there's nothing too objectionable or scary or whatever. And his young daughter likes to listen because she is fascinated by Lauren's voice because of the accent, the Welsh accent. And we'll get occasional emails from him with the little girl writing in questions for Lauren because Lauren's her new hero. And she, like, you know, writes questions like, my favorite one was, why is there a dragon on your flag? And is he a mean dragon or a happy dragon? You guys got such a cool flag.
Well, that goes that goes way back to a writer called Geoffrey of Monmouth. And have you ever heard of Geoffrey of Monmouth? He was.
I have not.
No, he wrote it in around about the year 1100, something of that period. Wrote a book called The History of the Kings of Britain, and in that book, which he claimed was based on ancient legends that basically predate the Romans coming here and everything. And anyway, by the way, and it's about two fighting dragons. There'd been a lot of trouble, and Merlin, the magician of King Arthur's stories, was called in to. I'm probably getting this completely wrong, but
I'm going with it anyway.
Yeah, I'll try. Was called in, and he discovered that there were these two fighting dragons, and the one vanquished the other, and it's thought to be a story about Wales fighting against the Anglo-Saxons who gave their name to England. So we've been constant enemies anyway. And it's not doesn't surprise me. I lived in England a long time, and there's every reason not to like the English. But no, so that story goes way back to these early legends, and that's where the dragons in Wales come from. But where they're supposed to have been fighting isn't that far away from where I live at the moment. So I live in the middle of this area of ancient stories of people. There's another writer called Gildas, who you probably haven't heard of either.
No.
Don't get me started on. He wrote a book called De Excidio et Conquisto et Britanniae, otherwise known. I did that just to show off.
Of course you did, because I'm like, sure. I think I've got that on order from Amazon right now.
Yeah, it's on the ruin and conquest of Britain, and he wrote it around about the year 500 as well, and so the book is really just a polemic against what he sees as the people responsible for the disastrous state of Britain at the time. But he's the one who mentions in a very damaged passage, he's the one that mentions the Battle of Badon, which the rest of everybody else credits to King Arthur. So it's the first reference to something Arthurian.
Okay.
She says was fought when he alive and present. So anyway, that's King Arthur.
Yeah, and Arthur's just pops up everywhere.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like, come on. Is it really that good a story, folks? Because he pops up everywhere in your history.
Well, yeah, I think the thing about Arthur is that, in my personal view, for what it's worth, which is probably not a lot, he's remembered for vanquishing the Anglo-Saxons, defeated them so badly that it took them half a century to recover, and so gave us a little bit of breathing space. Now, my personal view is that this was not considered very important at the time. It only became important as people look back on it when the Anglo-Saxons had beaten them. But they didn't know anything about Arthur or anything other than the fact that he won this battle, and so therefore they Arthur started to be given all the trappings of lots of other heroes, real and imagined, and so that's why you find him doing all these things and sometimes being an almost historical character and at other times clearly doing things that are legend and myth, but they're all put around him.
That leads to a question we got to ask, and I'm putting you on the spot for this one. Which Arthur is best? King Arthur? Arthur the album by the Kinks? Or Arthur the movie with Dudley Moore?
Well, generally speaking, I would have to say that far and away, King Arthur.
Oh, see, I'm going with the Kinks.
Well, as much as I like the Kinks, I don't think they sort of stack up that well in terms of age and length of their fame. They do go back an awful long way. I do admit that, yes. But King Arthur goes back further than that. And the Dudley Moore film is kind of, you think it's past its sell-by date now, or is it still of?
Well, you know, the theme song that Christopher Cross did is still a great song, and yeah, I think it's past its due. I'll tell you, because if I want to watch a Dudley Moore movie now, it's going to be like Bedazzled. At least something with Peter Cook in it.
Yeah, maybe. I was never a particularly big fan of either of them, really. So it is kind of putting me on the spot here, because I can't join in the conversation, because I watched Peter Cook and Dudley Moore a couple of times. But my favorite thing that they did, of course, is the one-legged Tarzan.
I
like that. Yes. There's nothing wrong with your left leg. It's a perfectly fine left leg.
My cat is coming back around because she loves the sound of your voice too. So we got to get back to Ripper research. And how nothing groundbreaking can be discovered or probably will be discovered. But like I said, you are the Mount Rushmore of this. You are among the ones that were the groundbreaking discoveries. As you said, you and Martin coming up with the other two names in the memorandum of the three suspects of the time. Do you look back on that discovery of yours and really appreciate how big a deal it was for this field of study?
Ooh, well, yes and no. I mean, you look back over the things that you've done and you realize that basically a good 80% of it was luck and just doing the right thing. For example, I'm quite proud of the Jack the Ripper A to Z that I did with Martin and Keith Skinner. And that the concept for that was actually my wife's, because she'd said to me one day, what you really need is a sort of encyclopedia that you can look at and check things and find out if like you would do in many other ways. And so I thought this was then I thought that was a good idea for a book, but the idea of actually selling that to a publisher, generating interest in that, would have been a nightmare, because they just weren't interested in that stuff, that type of stuff at the time. So it happened to be that I was taken out to lunch by my publisher. And they asked me, oh, well, what's your next book going to be? And I actually hadn't got one. I hadn't. And it sort of, the question took me by surprise, and I wasn't prepared for it. And I couldn't think of anything quickly enough of the books that I'd got ideas for. So I said this about this, the A to Z, and I was explaining the book almost as if it was a comical idea. And as I was doing that, I could see that she was quite literally buying it. And back in those days, that you didn't have to present your manuscript to a committee of people who would then decide whether they would go ahead with it. And 6 months later, they say yay or nay. You effectively sign the contract over lunch. And that basically happened, and I walked away with this the book having been bought, and thinking, God, what the hell have I got myself into now? I get researching this is going to be a nightmare. So that's how Keith and Martin came on board, thankfully, and the book was a success. Now, you know, those sort of things, you can look back now. I can look back over the history of this subject, because now Ripperology has its own history, and it has the peaks and troughs, and it's got the big discoveries and what leads one thing leads on to another, and you can trace back how these different books created a situation which led on to something else. So I'm very, very lucky in that Jack the Ripper, The Uncensored Facts, which was the first Jack the Ripper book to be fully sourced, and you know, I had footnotes and all this good stuff in the book. And it was the first to do that. Now, that showed that there was a market. And because the book did well, it showed that there was a market for that kind of book. And therefore, publishers were more keen to publish that type of book. So that book paved the way for other books of a serious nature. I cannot believe that in 1988, it would have been easy to find a publisher who would do the wonderful Stuart Evans and Keith Skinner Ultimate Source Book, which had, where Stuart had transcribed all the police and Home Office papers. And that book was groundbreaking because it meant that people, no matter where you lived, you could have access to the official files, and be able to sit and study and understand what the files were saying, in a pleasant home environment with a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, and be able to research in an easy and comfortable way. I can't imagine what possessed Stuart Evans to even start transcribing those papers. It's a mammoth task.
Well, Stuart's a different kind of cat.
Yeah, but he, you know, that's Stuart has got that book is hugely influential within the Ripper community. So when you start to look back over your contribution to things, no, you didn't realize at the time that it was going to be special or significant. You just...
Not only special and significant, still significant, because it is still updated and still published to this day.
Hmm.
When was the last update of the A to Z?
Oh, it's quite a while ago, because I'm working on a new update now with Sean Crundall and Deborah Arif, and who are both outstanding researchers. Leave me in the dust, you know. They're really, really good, and have uncovered so much detail that it's tremendous. And but it's just taking a long, long time to get this book written up. It's
although constant. You got to show, this is the respect your publisher had for you. You make that suggestion over lunch, and they're like, "Done, we want it." I was talking to my publisher recently. They asked me what I wanted to do for my next book. I said I'd really like to do a book about when the Irish Fenians attacked Canada, being the only time America invaded Canada, you know, in the 1860s. And how crazy is that, that a group, this ragtag group, tried to invade Canada right from here? And my publisher's response was, "Got any more wrestling book ideas?"
So, yes. Well, it yes, there's not an awful lot you can say about that, other than change your publisher, perhaps. Yeah. No, I mean, it is silly, but admittedly, however, the Fenian book would have a limited market, and
yeah, I understand. The publishers are there to make money. Stuff.
But there's just been a book published which on the Fenians, which I have here that I want to get into reading, but haven't had chance yet because there's so much other stuff that I've got to read.
Do you know the cool thing is where they launched their invasion of Canada?
Mm.
About 7 minutes from where I live.
Really?
Yeah.
So
that's why it's got a kind of personal, you know, soft spot in my heart, because it was right there.
Yeah.
And we're never taught about it in school or anything here.
No, it's a part of history that seems to have been forgotten by everybody except the Irish.
But you'd think, idiot, being here, we should be, "Hey, kids, look out that window. You see that? That's where America tried to invade Canada." No, not so much.
Well, there we go. I don't know why, but the Fenians fascinate me. I do have a sort of sneaking sympathy for all that, but we have a history here of Fenians and the Manchester Martyrs and people, but it's not widely known. People don't talk about it very much.
No, same thing here. Now we're gonna wrap up pretty soon because I know it's late there, and I know you're busy because you had said when I popped you up earlier and said I'm just finishing up work, you said I'm writing myself. So that tells me there's something new in the works for Paul Begg. Is there something you can tell us, or a little hints?
No, as you know, there's a journal called Ripperologist. Mm-hmm. And it has, and I do book reviews. I used to edit it, but it's the book side of it that interests me more than anything else, I suppose. And it's just been taken over by a fellow podcaster called Jonathan Menges, who's now taking over the editing of that, and he's putting the first issue together. And I had a book that we want to review for the first issue, and I am really struggling with doing the review, and that's what I was. I've got it ready. I have to send it off to him this evening, and I've got this sort of finished. I'm just sort of going through it and editing it and cutting out because it's rather long. But it's one of those things, you know, that you get every now and again where I don't actually understand what the hell the book is about. And I mean, I understand what the author has written, but I don't understand why it's been written, really. It's supposed to, I'm not sure what the author is trying to do at the beginning, because it's not clearly explained. And when we get to the conclusion and the results, I'm not really very impressed by any, and it doesn't seem to be telling me what it was supposed, what it seems to promise. I can't really explain this terribly well, but it doesn't happen very often when normally an author in some shape, way or form does explain to you at the beginning of the book what the book is about.
Not so much here.
And this book is either the explanation isn't clear and I'm completely missing it, or there isn't one and it's all dummied up and intended to try and pull the wool over your eyes and thinking that this is something really clever when in fact it isn't. And so I've read this book twice and I've been through it and I'm still not confident that I am actually understanding what the author is trying to do. It's not that I don't understand the words that have been written down or anything. It's just that the concept just seems to be escaping me all the time. And these are the problems that you get when you stick your nose into reviewing somebody else's book.
And how about Jonathan? Here's a guy who's been suffering from Ripper burnout for years, and now he's going to take on the task of editing Ripperologist?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of help. I think Jonathan, like all of us, believe it or not, I mean, I've been kicking around Ripper studies for 30 plus years, and I go through long periods of burnout and being fed up with the subject and wanting to get on and do something else. But for some reason, you know, you get stuck. You can't actually get out of it. It's a bit like being typecast as an actor.
You certainly can't, because, like I said, you're on the Mount Rushmore. No matter what happens, people are going to reference you or question you or ask you about it.
Yeah, and you know, it's great. I went to a meeting of a group called the Whitechapel Society recently. Now, that group was formed 30 years ago. I was the third person to give a talk to them, and they've never asked me back. So, you know, that's fame for you. You just do one thing. But anyway, I used to go all the time to these meetings. And I think they probably never asked me back, because it was a very awkwardly designed room that they used to have the meetings in this pub when it first started. And there were lots of pillars put round to break up the size of the room. And because of, I think it was something to do with the length of wire for the microphone that I got, but I ended up behind a pillar. So nobody could actually see me, but they could hear me. And so I'm not quite sure which was the best, really, being able
to. It's like the voice of the Ripper gods talking to the room at that point, because they didn't see you, just the voice.
Yeah, it's just this voice coming through. And so they never asked me back again, I think, not because they had any problem, but just because they weren't quite sure who it was they'd got talking that night. But I went to this meeting for the first meeting I've been to in well over 10 years. And there was the speaker and was introduced, and they just said, we have with us tonight there were two people over from Germany who'd come over to do an interview with Mark Galloway, who's the founder of the club. And so they said, and also Paul Begg. And there was a round of applause, and it took me completely by surprise. I hadn't expected anything. It took me completely by surprise, and I do. It's awfully nice, but and for things like that to happen, and afterwards people came up and said, oh, you know, you're the one who really inspired me to get involved in Ripper studies, and so grateful, and love your books and so forth. And that's really nice. But I find it acutely embarrassing.
You didn't just inspire me to dig into Ripperology, but writing in general.
Well, that surprises me again, you see, because I don't look at myself and think, oh, you know, you're anything particularly special. I mean, Martin Fido used to say that Jack the Ripper, the Uncensored Facts, was as dry as dust. So,
no offense, Martin was a different character, though. Come on.
Yeah. No offense, Paul, but it's it really is dry as dust. Martin was wonderful in so many ways. He was a great guy, but
Martin was. I spent a wonderful night in a bar with him in Baltimore, Maryland, that was just insane, because Martin loved being Martin. And if he could have the attention of a room, even if it weren't people who were there to see him, he would do it.
You see Martin in two different lights, really, because he at heart, Martin was an actor. And when Martin, in his, before I knew him, he had been in AmDrams, in amateur dramatics, and done it is acting that way. He also, as you know, did a radio series called Murders After Midnight, which was very good. And Martin, this great voice and a great way of delivering stuff. And so that catered for his acting talents, but he was a frighteningly intelligent man.
Incredibly so.
And so articulate and so well informed about so many things. And I gather that when he went to America and was teaching in Boston, his students were very fond of him, and they put up some nice posts on one of these teaching sites where your students can say rude things about you. And he had that, and he was just a natural born teacher. I think he could teach you without knowing that he was teaching you.
When Martin passed away, and I got the news that he passed away, one of the first things I did was go to that teaching site where students can leave review. I think, what was it? Rate My Professor, it was called.
Something like that, yeah.
And I spent the afternoon reading people's posts about Martin, going back several years. So there were positive and negative ones, and equally they made me laugh. The negative ones made me laugh knowing Martin just as much as the positive ones did.
I can understand that. There were a lot. Keith Skinner and I, we often reminisce about Martin, obviously, because he was a big part in our lives. But I always remember I landed in Boston and Martin picked me up, and I was staying at his house with Martin and his wife, and we were in the car and I started to talk about wrestling. And I said something along the lines of that it was a matter of suspending your sense of disbelief because of the things that the wrestlers do. And so there was one of my favorite things in wrestling was, you know, the you can have ignorance coming to the fore here, but when they have a whole bunch of wrestlers are there and
the Battle Royals.
Yeah, something like that. But anyway, it all got out of hand in theory, and you had the two sides belting Living Daylights out of each other, and then other guys were running down, and so it's the melee going on, and suddenly there's a crash of breaking glass, and it goes into the theme for Stone Cold Steve Austin marches down, and he clears the deck, you know, throws everybody out, and then pours beer all over himself. And you really honestly have to suspend your sense of disbelief, because this one guy isn't going to clear all these other men mountains. But on the tiniest bit of that breaking glass sound, the crowd cheered and were standing up, and they just knew what was going. Now that's suspending your sense of disbelief and the pleasure comes from doing that. And the phrase that I had used about suspending your sense of disbelief was something from a philosophical work of something like 1734. And Martin was most impressed that I knew this thing. And he said, "Oh, you've read whoever it was." And I "Don't you think?" And then he went into a long and extremely tedious lecture about this. And I said, now, I was actually talking about Stone Cold Steve Austin in wrestling. And he said, who?
Yeah.
And of course, I had to explain then. And so that was my tedious lecture. But that life was with Martin was sort of like that. It was very, he would completely get the wrong end of the stick sometimes of something that you'd said. But he believed, because I once sent him a card, he believed that I could speak Latin.
No matter what you tell him.
Yeah, because I sent him a card in which I had transcribed Waltzing Matilda in Latin. Now, I hadn't done this. Some other person had done it. And I'd merely copied it. But Martin thought that that was awfully clever that I'd done this and assumed that I was very good at Latin because I could do Waltzing Matilda. And I never, ever told him that I couldn't do anything in Latin at all. That Latin was a closed book as far as I was concerned. And he just persisted in believing. It was astonishing, really. I mean, he knew I was so pig ignorant in so many other ways. I can't understand why he would have imagined that conceivably that I was able to speak Latin at all.
Hey, you could have told him I speak Latin as well as I speak Welsh.
Well, he would have thought that I could speak Welsh as well.
Exactly.
But yeah, it was a sad day when we received that news that Martin was, he was still alive, of course, when we, few of us, learned that he'd had this horrible accident. In hospital, and was not thought to survive very long. We obviously hoped that it would be a lot longer, but not a pleasant way for Martin to have, or for anybody to have died, to have had an accident like that and be left in that state of that condition. But there we are.
Martin was a character. You know, it's funny because I'll tell you, I love Martin's books too, but I did prefer yours. I can't understand why he would say they were dry. I'm just saying, and I'm not just saying that because you're here and he's not. I prefer your books.
Well, that's very kind. I do as well, to be honest. I mean,
as well you should.
But no, I think the just to finish the one story about Martin, that we were all going somewhere, Keith, Martin and myself, and we got the underground. And Martin started to tell us something, and he carried on talking for the whole journey, wherever it was we were going. We got off the underground, negotiated the railway station or the underground station with him still talking. We got to the escalator and got separated, and Martin is way ahead of us on this really long escalator, being carried down into the bowels of the underground, and he's still talking. Keith and I can see him talking away, surrounded by all these people, and we finally catch up with him, and he's still talking, and he's completely oblivious to the fact that we haven't been there for the last 5 minutes, that we've been at the other end of the escalator. And it didn't seem to register with him at all that he was talking. Nobody was answering. Nobody was doing anything. He was just surrounded by a group of people thought he was a total madman.
I was going to say, they all thought he was deaf, so nobody was going to say anything.
But it was great. Mark Martin, sort of, as far as he was concerned, I suppose in his mind's eye, he was standing in front of a classroom and there were all these people and he wasn't expecting any response. It was just talked. It was wonderful. But he did teach you an awful lot. I mean, you and in a very subtle way, it wasn't until you had until later that you look back on it and you realized what had happened. But he never once really, apart from the dry as dust remark, he never put you down over anything. If you weren't very good at something, when he was, and especially when he was talking with other people, if they were not that bright, perhaps, he had enormous patience to be with people. But anyway, that we were talking about somebody that all the listeners probably haven't got the remotest idea who we're talking about.
The closest Martin ever came to quote unquote insulting me was not an insult. It was rather an insult to himself. Because we were standing at the bar in this pub at one point, and I'm 6'5" tall. And he's just looking up at me as we're talking, and then he finally just shakes his head, grabs me, and says, "We're sitting down because I feel too in." What did you say? Not insignificant standing next to you.
Well, yeah, it's not just your height though. You're quite big in other respects.
Oh, I'm a giant. Yeah.
So. Yes, and Martin wasn't comparable in size, so I can understand why he would have wanted.
I could have picked him up and put him in my pocket.
Yeah, I mean the thing that would be difficult for you and I, because unfortunately, if we meet, I'll be in a wheelchair and you'll be 6'5", so. You know, you'll have to bend over and we'll be passing notes to one another.
I would be more than honored to be passing notes in person with the great Paul Begg. But I'm going to let you go because it's late. You got to get to sleep.
You are got to get carry on writing. But I'll be glad. When this thing is finished, it shouldn't have taken me so long, but it's not been the easiest book to review. When you review a book, you know, it's a different thing to, you can't just go on endlessly and have, you know, 12,000 word book review. You have to sort of try and rein it in somewhere along the line. Anyway.
Unless you're making up for the book by writing a review that's better than the book itself.
Well, in this case, well, no, I shouldn't, because the author will know what I'm talking about. I don't want to be unjustly rude or insulting about something. People work hard on these books, and if they are slapdash about things and they don't care and it's just money that they're taking off readers, then I hate that and they get what they deserve. But you know, most people really struggle and these are really important things to them, these books, they're their children, and then you don't want some wally like me coming along and saying, "Oh, it's a load of rubbish." So
hey, I would be flattered to have you even call something I wrote rubbish. Knowing that you read it would make me happy.
There's something wrong with you, I think.
There is. I have hero worship. You understand?
Yes. Well, it's very nice. I must say it's very nice to have one's work appreciated. That's the good thing about people saying nice things about what you've done, is that really you don't get an awful lot of feedback, and so you sometimes you know you've done something that's reasonably good, hopefully, but it's nice to know that your work has been appreciated. The odd thing is that my favorite of my books is the one that hardly anybody ever mentions, which was a book called Jack the Ripper, The Definitive History. I was quite pleased with that. But
which they made into the documentary.
No, no, that's that was the document. They were two entirely different things. And
well, they used the title
I wrote the documentary with John Bennett, but somebody else gave it the name, but it didn't have any relation to the book, because the book was doing what you were talking about earlier. I wanted to set the crimes in their in what else was happening in Britain and elsewhere, but primarily in the East End of London at the same time, so that you could see the murders in context with the background. So I discussed a chapter on the police, another one on the newspapers, and so on, interspersed with an account of the murders. Now, that wasn't what we did in the documentary. The documentary was a straightforward account of the crimes and so forth. So the book and the documentary are completely different. They just fortunately have the same
title. And you know, the documentary, you got to realize this. In America, you narrated the documentary too, by the way, which is badass. But that documentary was released to theaters in America.
Mm.
A Jack the Ripper documentary, not on the History Channel or the Learning Channel. This was released to theaters in America. That's how big a deal it was.
Well, it's very gratifying that it did so well. There were things about it that I disliked immensely, but it was good, and I liked the opportunity of being able to do the narration. That was great. Although in America they did change it, and they had somebody to narrate it with an American accent. But
no, when I saw it in the theater, it was you.
Well, there's apparently some sort of split between the two, because I know that there was an alternative narration, but no, I thought that was good. I really enjoyed doing that. That was fun. But again, nobody's ever asked me to do another one. I really hope that, you know, I'd end up narrating a butter commercial or something, you know, that was,
well, that would be nice,
but not necessarily another full length documentary, but somebody once asked about narrating the Jack the Ripper, the facts, I don't know how these people narrate the books, read the books for Audible or whatever. Some are really awful, and then you get some who are really good, and they make the book more than the book itself was. And I'm pretty certain that I would be one of those that are pretty awful, really, in the long run. But halfway through the book, I'm sure I'd be falling off to sleep, or you know, just talking in a flat monotone.
Yeah, you just do it in sections. Although, another example of my publisher having such great respect for me, they said they were going to do an audio version of my book. And as I was talking to them, like, you know, you have such a great voice, you'd be great at doing audiobooks. Then they sent me a thing saying, yeah, so we just set up the audiobook. This person's going to be doing it. You just complimented me in my voice. Now you gave it to someone else.
Well, you do have a good voice. Yeah, I can't imagine what they were thinking when they did that, because the voice, you know, you'd have been fine.
Yeah, you'd be, I don't know.
I love little secret is that when I get the time, I like reading Westerns.
Who doesn't?
Well, a lot of people. And so I don't broadcast it very often. But I love Louis L'Amour. And there's a whole load of Louis L'Amour audible books, talking books, most of which I've got and listened to. And there's a guy called Jason Culp, and he reads these. He's really good. I'm very, very impressed with that. And it's, you have to have a certain voice to be able to narrate a cowboy book, you know, a Western.
Yeah, they're not going to let a New Yorker like me do that.
No, or anybody with a squeaky voice or, you know, anything this odd. It has to be a sort of good, solid, but slightly scratchy voice. The voice has to convey the open plains and the cow towns and so forth. It's and a gunslinger, of course.
Yeah, which is, again, people hear me, they're like, it sounds like a Canadian from New York.
Hmm.
No one's letting me do it.
But I would love for some of the old Western TV series to be shown over here. But we, all those Warner Brother ones like Laramie and things like that, they're not shown here at all. I was thrilled that we had the Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp with Hugh O'Brien seems to be on one of the Netflix or something.
See, I'm lucky that I have, I don't know if they have them there, something called a Roku stick.
Yep, I think there is, but we don't get the same programming as you do.
There's a lot of free channels available on Roku. You just search through them, and I have like four or five different free Western channels.
Mm. But
wonderful.
But yeah, they don't. Maverick is the only one that's. I think they're showing a bit of Bonanza on one channel at the moment. But otherwise, it's the kind of stuff that you never heard of at the time. Not that it was bad. It was just that I don't think it was ever originally shown in this country, like Stagecoach West or Stagecoach West. Yeah. Anyway, we're drifting. We're going off on tangential subjects.
We are. But I want to ask you, will you promise to come back on the show any point you want to discuss anything you want? You are always welcome here.
Well, thank you. But yes, it's your listeners that I have to have sympathy for. They have to put up with me if wittering on and indeed you. So, you know, they're a tough bunch out there. So yes, I would love to come back. I'm sure they would be able to put up with me.
Yes. Bunch of masochists in my audience. They tune into me every week. I don't understand it. And no, they write me emails and, you know, they're a weird bunch. But we love them, so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank God somebody does.
That's right. That's why they tune to me, because no one else will listen to them.
Yeah, I'm sure. They're a wonderful, wonderful bunch of masochists out there.
Oh, tons of them. Well, then I'm going to wrap this up so you can get back to work and go to bed, and I can feed my cats before they turn me into dinner, because they give me that look at, like, around this certain time.
Yeah, so, now I can understand that.
Yeah, so I am going to say, from the legend Paul Begg in Wales, UK, this is Brian in Buffalo saying good night.
Good night, and thank you.
You consent to being recorded. That's bullshit.
Do you consent?
Okay.